Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 90. It's Monday, November 30th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. COVID-19 continues raging on. Of course, the Trump effect is also taking its toll. That is, testing is so jammed up and backed up that it's increasingly harder to get tested if you want to, and if you are able to get tested, the number of days you have to wait for a result make the results increasingly useless. Plus, this all feeds back into less people even bothering to seek a test unless they are experiencing more severe disease. So, the proportion of actual infections identified is decreasing, and testing limitations may put a ceiling on the number of new cases able to be identified. This may look deceptively like a slowing or flattening of the curve, when actually, it just means that we are flying increasingly blind. In fact, in Ohio, this last week was the first decrease in weekly overall testing numbers since September. Even with increased test demand for holiday travel and students returning home. Okay, for a quick check-in where we are as a nation, this from CBS News. U.S. reported more COVID-19 cases in November than most countries had all year. The United States reported more than 4 million coronavirus cases in November, which is higher than the total number of cases seen all year by any country in the world except India and Brazil. Public health experts are warning that the U.S. will keep seeing record-breaking numbers in the final month of 2020. Since the pandemic began, the U.S. has seen more than 13.3 million confirmed cases and about 267,000 deaths, by far the highest numbers in the world. The United States accounts for nearly 20% of the global death toll. That's with about 4% of the world's population. Okay, well, I really wanted to begin our COVID-19 coverage with a little reflection on a concept I've talked about before, and that is the worst of both worlds. What I mean by that is the fact that public health and the economy are intricately entwined, and we seem to be divided as a nation fighting about which one to do, and it's causing a failure on both fronts. So we're seeing public health overwhelmed and economic devastation, each making the other worse. And as failures mount, health and economic inequalities will deepen and cripple our nations for years to come. Of course, this is all based on a false dichotomy between functioning public health and functioning economy. Now, this last week, President-elect Joe Biden stated that we are fighting the virus, not each other. And while I would say we should be fighting the virus, not each other, I would say if you're accepting reality, we are fighting each other. We are a deeply divided nation. And I think that's what's driving this worst of both worlds, is that because we cannot get a handle on the public health crisis, because we seem to think that there's this false choice, there's this choice between supporting the economy and supporting public health, that we've hamstrung, in fact, our public health efforts. And I would say that without federal COVID relief, which would make it possible to knit together an effective public health and economic recovery, we will in fact be hamstrung or short-circuited. Take your metaphor. Probably the best example of this is that we keep open across most of the country bars and restaurants with indoor dining, and this is driving the epidemic. Yet we are seeing community after community being forced to close schools. We're getting these things out of order, and that's because, you know, basically we don't have either even state or national strategic plans on how we're going to knit together a sensible public health and economic approach to this pandemic. Okay, well, I have four articles that kind of get at this whole idea of kind of the worst of both worlds and how if we as people don't plan effectively, COVID will shut us down and do it for us. Okay, well, first up, from the Columbus Dispatch, COVID worsens bus driver shortages nationwide in many Ohio schools. They installed hand sanitizer dispensers on the buses. They created seating charts to keep children apart. They reconfigured bus routes and altered school schedules to ensure that they had the time and space needed to transport every child. None of it matters if the bus driver's seat is empty. The pandemic is exacerbating a nationwide shortage of bus drivers that experts say existed long before the health crisis. Many drivers, especially those who are older and more at risk for health complications, aren't working so they can avoid exposure to the virus. Even during a normal year, qualified drivers are often lured away by jobs in the private sector that pay better and offer more consistent hours, local officials said. We have transportation supervisors and office staff, and in some districts, even mechanics helping to cover routes, myself included, said Randy Snyder, president of the Ohio Association for Pupil Transportation. Snyder is also the supervisor for the Westerville School District's transportation department. National surveys before the pandemic estimated about 20% of jobs industry-wide are unfilled, Snyder said. It's not an urban issue. It's not a small township issue, Snyder said. It's an industry issue, and it's definitely affecting everyone. Last week, students at the Groveport Madison School District didn't have bus rides the entire week due to a COVID-19 outbreak among transportation employees. As of last Friday, 15 employees were infected and many others were forced to quarantine due to possible exposure, reducing a staff of nearly 100 people by about a third. Originally, district officials planned to continue offering in-person classes twice a week, with parents bringing their children to school if possible. But due to staffing shortages elsewhere in the district, all classes started going online last Wednesday. On Wednesday, the Licking Heights District also moved all its classes online due to staffing shortages, with its transportation department greatly impacted. The Bellefontaine District, about 60 miles northwest of Columbus, suspended 9 of its 12 bus routes in early October because of the virus, but eventually found enough substitutes to operate most of them. It's not enough just to find someone who's willing to drive a bus, officials say. School bus drivers must hold a commercial driver's license, pass background checks, and complete any necessary training with their district, a process that often can take weeks, explained Monte Detterman, the Southwestern School District's Director of Business Services. Most people don't understand how much goes into getting them certified, Detterman said. To reduce the potential spread of the virus, many districts are allowing only one student per seat, lessening bus capacity. State officials don't require any specific distancing protocols. Some school districts have asked their transportation supervisors, if we decide to go back to school 100% next week, what would you do? They said, close, said Simons, who was the Columbus City Schools transportation director for more than a decade. There's just not enough people left. We're going to have to ease back into this thing. In a 2016 survey conducted by the National Association, 56% of respondents indicated their driver shortage is getting much worse. More than half of that 56% said the situation is severe or desperate for their school district or transportation company. Of surveyed bus drivers, 88% said pay was a major factor in recruitment and retention, while 62% cited the hours that work is available. The median pay for school bus drivers was about $33,000 annually last year, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Another factor some say is complicating busing. In Ohio, public districts are not only required to bus their own students in grades K through 8, but also offer busing to students in those grades who live within their boundaries but are attending private or charter schools. That's why Columbus City Schools, the state's largest district with just under 50,000 students, is already busing about 13,000 students to school every day, even though its own students are all learning online. Due to the number of students bused every day, transportation is a major factor of plans for now and when students returned for blended learning with classes in person twice weekly, said Wortman, the district spokesman. For now, they'll stay online through at least mid-January. Okay, and in more international news related to supply issues, this from The Hill. Major glove factories close after thousands of workers test positive for COVID-19. The largest rubber glove manufacturer in the world said this week that orders would be delayed by weeks and some of its factories would shut down after thousands of its workers tested positive for COVID-19. According to the company, deliveries could be delayed for up to 4 weeks and new orders could take even longer. As Reuters notes in its report, shares of the company have shot up in value this year due to the high demand for personal protective equipment. The company commands a quarter of the global latex glove market. Top Glove's production capacity will likely be reduced to 50% of what it normally produces, according to the Malaysian Industrial Development Finance Research Analyst. Malaysia produces nearly two-thirds of all rubber gloves in the world. The other two major glove manufacturers are not believed to have the capacity to make up for the expected delay caused by Top Glove's shutdowns. Okay. And getting back to Franklin County from the Columbus Dispatch, recent COVID-19 surge affecting contact tracing efforts, Franklin County cuts back. The recent surge in COVID-19 cases has strained public health department's ability to do contact tracing, and in the case of Franklin County, to cut back its efforts. Since the pandemic began in March, public health departments have employed staffers who contact those infected by the coronavirus and ask them who they have been around. The idea is to then call those other people at risk of infection and ask them to quarantine for 14 days to avoid spreading the virus. In a statement issued by the Franklin County Health Commissioner Joe Mazzella, he said, "The surge has caused us to reevaluate how we will be temporarily conducting contact tracing." Mazzola said county officials now will cut back to contacting those newly infected, but will not then try to contact all of those who that person has been in contact with. Instead, officials will give them, quote, tools and guidance to identify and notify their close contacts themselves. Robert said as the pandemic has worsened, the contact tracing staff has mushroomed from 50 to more than 200 people, and it can be a grueling job. It is hard on our staff, she said. When we get 800 new cases reported to us in a day, as they had 964 the day before this report, that is almost crippling to our team. They look at that number and say, oh my goodness, how are we going to manage that? My team is resilient, hardworking, dedicated, and passionate, but they have been doing this for 9 months. It has been challenging, to say the least. Robert said Thanksgiving was the first day her office was closed since the pandemic began. 7 days a week, including on holidays, at least some staffers have been at work. Another hardship, she said, was that some people who are contacted are not always the most pleasant to our staff. They're not happy to hear from us. Robert said compliance among those who are called is in the 70 to 80% range. At the beginning of the pandemic, people reported an average of three others they had been in contact with, but that number is now more like 5 to 8 people, she said. That exponentially increases how many calls staffers must make. Despite the hardships involved, Robert said the work is too important not to continue. We're trying to reduce the spread, she said. If with one case we can get in touch with all five people they were in contact with and get them to quarantine and not expose someone else, maybe we can make some inroads with this virus. But of course, this article is a good example of when the waves wash over the barriers. What you were doing before is more than just hampered a bit. Okay, well, of course, when we're talking about the worst of both worlds, the segment in healthcare is affected the most, and of course, the most directly affecting the outcomes for people that are infected. This from Stat News. Beyond burnout, for healthcare workers, this surge of COVID-19 is bringing burnover. COVID-19 is roaring back for a third wave. The first two substantially increased feelings of moral injury and burnout among healthcare workers. This one is bringing burn over. Healthcare systems are scrambling anew. The crisis of ICU beds at capacity, shortages of personal protective equipment, emergency rooms turning away ambulances, and staff shortages are happening this time not in isolated hotspots, but in almost every state. Clinicians again face work that is risky, heart-rending, physically exhausting, and demoralizing, all the elements of burnout. They have seen this before and are intensely frustrated it is happening again. Too many of them are leaving healthcare long before retirement. The disconnect between what healthcare workers know and how the public is behaving, driven by relentless disinformation, is unbearable. Paraphrasing a colleague, how can they call us essential and then treat us like we are disposable? It is time for leaders of hospitals and healthcare systems to add another, deeper layer of support for their staff by speaking out publicly and collectively in defense of science, safety, and public health, even if it risks estranging patients and politicians. Long before the pandemic emerged, the relationships between healthcare organizations and their staffs were already strained by years of cost-cutting and trimming staff levels, supplies, and space to the bone. Driven by changes in the healthcare reimbursement structures, systems were, quote, optimized to the point that they were continually running at what felt like full capacity, with precious little slack to accommodate minor surges, much less one of the magnitude of a global pandemic. We are now facing a convergence of two cataclysms. The abject failure of preparedness driven by the dogma that market forces can best shape healthcare, and the catastrophic failure at the highest levels of leadership in the U.S. to adequately address and control the pandemic. Healthcare workers are left to manage in the ensuing chaos, feeling disposable, devalued, and demoralized. Wearing a mask, the best prevention against a pathogen for which there are no curative therapeutic measures, is optional in 26 states. Pandemic isolation fatigue is real, and large gatherings are increasingly common. Thanksgiving celebrations will likely fuel the spread of COVID-19. Deborah Birx's uncharacteristically sharp warning to the White House, we are entering the most concerning and most deadly phase of this pandemic, adding that an aggressive, balanced approach is not being implemented, belies her grave concern. In the absence of leadership from elected and appointed officials, those at the heart of care, doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, social workers, transport specialists, cleaners, dining service workers, and others are a bucket brigade trying to staunch a pandemic wildfire. Hospitals are grasping for solutions to support their strained workforces. Recharge rooms, tranquility tents, and peer support programs drawn from various initiatives in other environments are popping up everywhere. Some hospitals have carts with snacks, tea, water, and anti-fog goggle spray, tokens to remind their staff amid the taxing trials of their work that leadership cares. And yet levels of distress, which were already high before the pandemic, are rising. Instead of more resilient strategies, which healthcare workers already understand are symbolic trinkets, what they need is to know who truly has their backs in this fight. In March, clapping for essential workers was a powerful signal that individuals and communities were grateful for the efforts of those at most risk. But those expressions of gratitude, when co-opted by marketing departments, left healthcare workers skeptical of their authenticity and cynical about future such efforts on their behalf. Were the expressions of gratitude and support genuine, or were they intended to create good glossies for hospital fundraising? Does the mental health of workers really matter, or does it just make good copy? No matter how well-intended these efforts of support were, they often further erode trust between staff and organizations rather than foster it. As a crisis looms, it is not possible to deliver a just-in-time resilient community. Creating a deep-seated, meaningfully, mutually supportive relationship between an organization and its workforce takes time. Healthy communities build reserves of trust, goodwill, respect, and caring they can call on during crises. Such efforts must be in place before a crisis hits and extended long after it resolves. Otherwise, building the community is another drain on resources already stretched to the breaking point. There's an epidemic in this country of not listening to those in distress. Healthcare leaders must stop offering solutions before getting deeply curious about the problem and asking staff what they need. Administrators and clinicians must be equal partners at the table where decisions affecting care are made and where resources are allocated. Supporting healthcare workers' mental health is not just about supporting individuals as they cope with unimaginable situations. It is also about improving the environment, processes, policies, and cultures of institutions and their communities. It is about recognizing and clearing away bureaucratic barriers to make it as easy as possible for staff to do exceptionally difficult jobs. Healthcare workers want to see the leaders of their institutions, particularly the country's largest healthcare systems, loudly, publicly, and collectively advocate for the aggressive, balanced approaches Burks alluded to. They want their leaders to spend an hour on rounds with them, seeing and feeling the realities they face and working collaboratively on solutions, rather than offering a hospital-branded bottle of water. For months, healthcare workers have been trying to put out the fire of this pandemic bucket by bucket. They have been waiting for the public to realize the enormity of the threat and to accept the necessity of simple sacrifices for the greater good, wearing a mask, physical distancing, and avoiding larger gatherings. They have been waiting for elected leaders to call the country together and ask them to rise above their individual interests. They have been waiting for someone to see the enormous and growing risk that healthcare workers face. This isn't happening, and they are losing hope. They are tired, and the wind is against them, and their voices are getting hoarse. Still reeling from the burnout of the first surges, they're watching COVID-19 cases soar and imagining the very real threat of pandemic burnover. The fire trucks and water drops that might stop pandemic burnover are the simple measures each individual can do to limit transmission. If healthcare leaders loudly, insistently, and collectively call for these measures, it will be a statement of solidarity with their workforce and the first step to rebuilding trust, embracing collaboration, and most importantly, to saving the lives of healthcare workers and the public.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get to a local COVID-19 update. Okay, well, in Lucas County, we have seen an increase now to about 347 confirmed COVID-19 cases each day. That is up from 253 a day that I reported on my last show about a week ago. So we've seen over a third increase recently. Yikes, still seems to be skyrocketing. Although, like I say, with some jam up of testing, we'll see if we hit a ceiling with that. Okay, well, if we look at the positivity rate for the last 9 days, which it's getting a little weird the way that's been reported, and the holidays kind of mess that up a bit. So a 10-day period. During that 10-day period, we saw a positivity rate of 27%. Now, that was, over those 10 days, almost 11,000 tests, or about 1,100 tests a day, which is up from the previous period that I reported on, which is only about 600 tests a day. So there was definitely a spike. There's definitely been some surge testing that the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department was doing. They were trying to get UT students to get tested before the holidays and coming out of school and students going back home and that type of thing. But even with that, a huge dump of tests just today, like most of those tests were actually just dropped today, that brought it down to a positivity rate of 27%. Now, last week, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department did report that their positivity rates was between 15 and 20%, although I don't know exactly where they're getting that numbers from. I'm just looking at the publicly reported data, and there is does seem to be a lag, particularly of total number of tests. I think the negative tests are having quite a bit of lag. I mean, we're seeing that for a person and for the health department to get a positive test result reported is over 4 days. That's the positive tests which are prioritized. So certainly for negative tests, it's going to be longer than that. And of course, there's often a range depending on when and where you had the test taken. Okay, so even if it's close to 27%, even if it's 15 to 20%, as they're saying a week ago or so, that's very, very high. And we have seen in Ohio that our positivity rate has gone up to 14.5% for the entire state. That's up from the previous week reported 13.1%, and that's over double it was about a month ago. So that keeps rising. And again, the standard of where we'd like to get the positivity rate is under 5% to indicate that we're doing enough testing to identify a larger proportion of the actual cases. Okay, nursing homes, one of the most dangerous places to be in this epidemic. We saw the active cases rise from 134 in the previous week to this most recent week, 161. So that's going up roughly proportional to the total cases overall. And we've seen that positivity rate go up in Lucas County, long-term care facilities, the testing that they're doing, 17.8% of those tested are coming back positive. Yikes, scary. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 weeks prior to that, it was 4.9%. So it just keeps going up and up. This is very dangerous. This is where I'm hopeful the vaccine will come in and put a backstop on that in the next month or so. Okay, University of Toledo is out this week. It won't be back till at least the new year. They didn't actually report a number of cases in the last week because, like I said, the health department was doing some testing on campus there, so it kind of messed up their normal kind of surveillance testing that they did for some reason. I'm not sure exactly why, but they didn't report the number of positive tests. They just did the community testing that the health department put in a pop-up site there. Okay, well, schools, which, as you may have heard, are closing, if not already, this week. We did see 62 staff infected and 70 students in Lucas County in the most recent week reported. But as we're seeing, schools are closing. So hopefully that'll go down. We're not seeing spread in the schools, except for a limited amount of people. There is some K through 6 and face-to-face, but wholesale, that is ending. And I wanted to read, I did listen to the press, not the press conference, it was the actual Toledo Lucas County Health Department board meeting where they were discussing this school closing order. And I wanted to read most of that order for you so you can hear it straight from them, how they're framing this. Okay, Lucas County Regional Health District Resolution Number 2020-11-189 in the matter of order for schools in Lucas County. Preamble. Governor Mike DeWine has emphasized that in-school education during the pandemic is a desired model, but noted each locality would have to determine the best educational process based on current local conditions. In-person learning provides invaluable social interactions and learning conditions, which greatly benefit the student. Almost all Lucas County schools have taken the necessary means to create barriers and conditions that limit transmission in schools during moderate COVID conditions. Whereas most local, state, and federal public health and educational officials support an in-person educational process over virtual when possible, Toledo Lucas County Health Department has closely been monitoring schools for confirmed COVID-19 infections and exposures among students and staff. Through contact tracing with these individuals, little in-school transmission has been documented. Under moderate community spread, schools can, with the necessary precautions and COVID-19 mitigation strategies, operate with some expectation of controlling the disease in their classrooms. However, as community spread increases, so does the risk for transmission of COVID within schools. And whereas the CDC has indicated the highest risk of transmission in schools occurs when average new cases per day are 200 or greater and the positivity rate is 10% or greater, community spread conditions continue to worsen in Lucas County with average cases per day exceeding 230 and a positive rate between 15% and 20%. Lucas County has been designated as a red or high-risk county and is approaching the highest risk level, purple, by the state designation. This risk level would mean all or nearly all of the medical criteria are being met or exceeded. This includes hospital admissions, emergency room visit volume, ventilator use, and outpatient visits, among others. Lucas County has seen an increase in all these indicators over the past several weeks, as have many other areas in Ohio. Lucas County hospitals are experiencing staffing shortages due to COVID, and several hospitals have engaged bypass status, where ambulances must divert patients to other facilities. When looking at disease incidence in a population, 100 cases per 100,000 populations in a week is considered a high incidence rate. Lucas County is currently exceeding five times that rate with over 500 cases per 100,000. And whereas community spread continues to increase while amplifying the risk to our community and schools, public health cannot maintain its confidence in a safe working or learning environment under today's conditions. One reason is the current time frame surrounding testing. Currently, it takes an unacceptable 5 to 7 days to begin contact tracing of students or other community members, greatly reducing the effectiveness of COVID mitigation strategies. Without ample testing capability, 72 hours to begin contact tracing, isolation and quarantine has limited mitigation effectiveness. From past holidays, a noted increase in disease within the community has been seen starting 7 to 10 days following the observed holidays. With Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's occurring within the next 38 days, it is expected Lucas County will be impacted with significant burden of new cases from these holidays, and slow testing will be a barrier to adequate isolation and quarantine of students. Compounding this problem, there is a lag time of 1 to 3 weeks before many infections, hospitalizations, and fatalities associated with COVID-19 are seen. And whereas the use of face masks, hand hygiene, and limited social gatherings are effective tools that help mitigate the spread of COVID-19, closure of schools is another measure to help decrease the severity of COVID-19 in Lucas County. School closures have been shown to reduce spread and slow the epidemic by 40 to 60%, and the reference for that is in this document. If you want to look it up on their website, lucascountyhealth.org. An advocate for in-school education, Benjamin Linus, MD, MPH, and Associate Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology at Boston University School of Medicine stated, "You can only open your school safely if you have COVID under control in your community. And whereas school-aged children appear to be infected and spread COVID-19 differently than adults, in the United States, the rate of infection is twice as high in children aged 12 to 17 as it is among 5 to 11-year-olds. Children 5 to 11 years of age do not appear to be effective spreaders or extensive acquirers of COVID-19. However, those in grades 7 through 12 do have a greater potential for spread of COVID due to the way classes are structured, moving from class to class, and through increased interaction inside and outside of school. Whereas universities in Ohio will be going virtual and will be off campus from Thanksgiving until after the New Year holiday, these dates also consider approximately when increased cases should be seen in the community due to Thanksgiving, Christmas, and after the New Year's. And whereas from the public health perspective, it is imperative to mitigate the potential increase of COVID cases in our schools and community with the understanding that students perform best when physically present in school and that significant disease spread is greatest with increased interaction between persons, the following order was developed through deliberate and extensive consideration to protect schools, attempt to limit community spread of COVID-19, and focus available resources and mitigation strategies to those at greatest need." Okay, so they basically say all Lucas County schools, including public, private, charter, and parochial schools, will close all school buildings from December 4th, 2020 at 4 p.m. to January 11th, 2020 at 8 a.m. The board highly recommends that all schools not wait until December 4th, but close immediately. and in regards to sports and extracurricular activities, to limit COVID-19 spread among students, all sports and extracurricular activities are prohibited from utilizing any school building interior space for practice or contest during the same period. Okay, well, some of you may remember that a week prior to this, the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department and its board gave a stay-home advisory, which of course does not have the force of law. It's hard to say what effect that's actually had, but this is actually a public health order. They have the legal ability to close schools in a public health emergency. And the emergency, of course, is that we're being overwhelmed already in some of our healthcare facilities, and we expect this only to get worse. And if we don't mitigate community spread, it's going to get a whole lot worse locally. Okay, well, as we all mostly know, that a specific part of the healthcare system that is particularly affected is long-term care facilities. So let's look at this story from NBC News. COVID-19 outbreaks in nursing homes hit record high. The latest surge of coronavirus cases is fueling a record number of nursing home outbreaks as the virus is spreading quickly inside long-term care facilities in the Midwest and Great Plains, while also re-emerging in facilities swamped by the first wave of the virus. More than 1,300 nursing homes across the U.S. reported having three or more confirmed cases during the first week of November, the highest number ever reported in a single week, according to an NBC News analysis of federal data. The figure does not include outbreaks at assisted living facilities, which the government does not track. But nursing homes across the country are still reporting shortages of protective equipment and testing delays. As of the first week of November, 1 in 10 facilities said they did not have a week's supply of N95 masks, according to the federal data. Nearly a third of all nursing homes said they had to wait 3 to 7 days to receive COVID-19 test results. Providers worry that access to both protective equipment and testing will become more difficult as case numbers continue to rise. The federal government unveiled new testing guidelines in late August, requiring staff members to be tested monthly, weekly, or twice a week, depending on a county's overall positivity rate. But nursing homes are still facing difficulty getting access to tests, freeing up staff members to administer them, and covering the costs, according to Leading Age, an industry group that represents nonprofit long-term care facilities. Our pleas are being ignored. The support we have received has been insufficient and is running out quickly, Katie Sloan Smith, president and CEO of Leading Age, said on a press call. The virus is raging, infection rates are skyrocketing, and the pool of financial support is running low. The national stockpile, intended to be a backstop for healthcare facilities that have exhausted their supplies, is also facing shortfalls. In July, the federal government said it wanted to have a 90-day supply of critical personal protective equipment on hand. As of last week, however, the strategic national stockpile had only about half of the 300 million N95 masks needed and less than 1% of the gloves needed to meet the target, according to figures from the Department of Health and Human Services. And I'll just note editorially that previous story I did about the supply chain in Malaysia, biggest glove manufacturer, having thousands of positives in their factory and going to be delaying. So Strategic National Reserve only has 1% of the gloves needed to meet the target. So even something as simple as that in healthcare may not be available in some or all places. Okay. Even more concerning are widespread staffing shortages. 1 in 5 nursing homes across the U.S. report shortages of aides, and 17% have shortages of nurses, according to the latest federal data. While adequate staffing at long-term care facilities has long been a problem because of low wages and challenging working conditions, the pandemic has worsened the staffing shortages, with new research linking that to higher COVID-19 infection rates. We're going to see more and more staffing shortfalls around the country as staff become sick and really unwilling to work in conditions where they don't feel protected and they don't feel supported in terms of their pay or their benefits, said David Grabowski, professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. Victoria Richardson, who earns $14 an hour as a certified nursing assistant at a Chicago area nursing home, said her facility has been bleeding staff members since the beginning of the pandemic. When the first wave of the virus hit Forest View Rehabilitation and Nursing Center in the spring, management began providing hazard pay of $200 every 2 weeks, but it stopped the extra payments in August, she said. Now staff members at the facility are becoming infected again, according to federal records. But the hazard pay has not come back to Forest View or other Chicago area nursing homes run by Infinity Healthcare Management, according to the Service Employees International Union Healthcare, which represents Richardson and other staff members. Infinity Healthcare Management did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Richardson, 51, has been struggling to pay her bills since her husband died of cancer in September, and she now fears losing her home. She also still worries about contracting the virus, which has killed 18 residents at Forest View since the beginning of the pandemic. Even now, she said, staff members struggle to get proper protective equipment. On Monday, Richardson and nearly 700 other Infinity nursing home workers went on strike to demand higher pay and proper protective equipment. I have to reuse the same mask for a week, and I don't get an N95 unless I insist on having it, Richardson said. Okay, now let's take a moment for a PSA about WAKT fundraising. While many are suffering from a loss of connection amid the pandemic, WAKT is working hard to counter that by fostering connections between Toledoans. By providing a platform for local talent to be heard by the public, our station is working hard to put the community in community radio. Unfortunately, the pandemic has hampered our ability to fundraise, and that's why we need your help. Beginning on December 1st, Giving Tuesday, we will be launching a donation drive with the goal of raising $3,000 for the station. This will ensure that all of our licensing and insurance is covered, and that we continue to be a way for Toledoans to connect with each other. In exchange for your contribution, we will be providing a number of thank you items, including copies of our compilation album of local musicians, the quarantine sessions, a chapbook of local writers, homegrown Toledo creatives, and prints from local artists like Chris Rodriguez, Hannah Starseed, and Dawn Bucklew. Mark your calendars and prepare to make your donation starting December 1st at www.toledoradio.org. Please note, if we have a successful fundraising drive, my salary will be tripled from zero to zero. Okay, and remember, you can always listen to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo online anytime at toledoradio.org. Okay, back to the show. Well, amidst all the bad news with COVID, we're pinning a lot of hopes on the vaccines coming down soon. Looks like themselves, they are very effective, but actually getting them into arms of people is going to be a real issue. Let's take a look at this story from Wired. Winning trust for a vaccine means confronting medical racism. The U.S. has a long history of abusing minorities for pharmaceutical profit. Messaging for a COVID-19 inoculation will have to overcome that past. Whenever the United States gets access to a coronavirus vaccine, and that hope for a date keeps shifting from the White House's boast of achieving it before the election to Anthony Fauci's estimate of maybe January, one early push will involve getting the shot to people most in danger of becoming seriously sick or dying from COVID-19. That is looking more difficult all the time, and not only because of the calendar. Some people, and this includes state governors, are concerned that vaccine approval may be fast-tracked for political benefit, but others are suspicious of a vaccine because of well-documented mistreatment of members of minority groups in medical research. Polls already show rising suspicion of the vaccine, even though at this point none of the candidates has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration and no final data about safety or efficacy has been released. Several national polls taken since the summer show that up to two-thirds of people plan to wait at least several months after a formula becomes available to see whether adverse reactions occur. One-quarter to one-third of poll respondents said they plan to never take the vaccine. As the U.S. government scrambles to protect its residents from COVID-19, it is simultaneously having to confront and try to unwind decades of justified distrust. Our message can't be that we are shaming people for not being interested or making them feel bad for not protecting their health, says Margo Savoy, a physician who chairs the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Temple University's School of Medicine. People are saying no because they are genuinely afraid. And if you dismiss people's fears without helping them to have a reason to trust you, we will lose them, and not just for the vaccine. Responding to that hesitancy, several groups have announced recently that they plan to make their own reviews of the vaccine data once it becomes available. The National Medical Association, a professional society for African American and Black physicians, announced in September that is creating a task force to scrutinize any vaccine that receives the FDA's emergency use authorization, a shortcut to a traditional new drug approval. A few days later, Governor Andrew Cuomo created a vaccine review commission for New York State. Then in October, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that California would also independently review safety data before allowing any new vaccine to be given there. Oregon, Washington, and Nevada joined the California effort last week. So whichever vaccine arrives first, skepticism will be waiting for it. Researchers and public health planners already snarled in how to manage the fastest vaccine research program in history, are trying to think through how to mitigate that. Ensuring that the data is transparently made available to the public as quickly as possible will be really critical as far as reassuring the public about the safety and efficacy of the vaccines, says Evan Anderson, a physician and professor at Emory Medical School, an investigator in Emory's Vaccine Treatment and Evaluation Unit, which is conducting several COVID-19 vaccine trials. But at some level, it will be hard to completely reassure people until large numbers of people actually receive the vaccine. This gets tricky because it's almost certain that some recipients of the new vaccine will experience some kind of transient reaction to them, not necessarily the very serious side effects that have shown up once per 100,000 or per 100 million doses in past vaccine campaigns, but fever, fatigue, and muscle and joint pain. We know this is likely, even though there is no comprehensive data yet, because some recipients have described reactions in media reports, and two companies, Pfizer and Moderna, documented reactions in medical journal accounts of their small phase 1 safety trials. Plus, some of the vaccines we take all the time come with brief reactions after inoculation. Flu vaccines cause headache, muscle ache, and fatigue in up to a third of adult recipients. And flu-like illness, not the actual flu, but a sign of the immune system reacting to the antigen in 5% of older people with chronic diseases. And the vaccine against shingles is notorious for after effects. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tells people who take it that they will likely be slowed down for 2 to 3 days. One of the challenges of putting out messages about the new vaccine, Anderson says, will be convincing people that any similar symptoms aren't a danger signal. That's not a safety issue. These are expected reactions, he says. A safety issue is, are there issues related to receiving the vaccine that put you at increased risk of hospitalization or unusual events? A safety issue, for instance, would be the occurrence of Guillain-Barré paralysis that followed the 1976 swine flu inoculation, or the cases of narcolepsy that occurred after some children in Europe received the 2009 H1N1 flu vaccine, not whether you feel fluish or have a sore arm. So, reactions may be common, and they may be misunderstood. Now, layer that reality on top of two other phenomena. One is that racial and ethnic minorities in the U.S. have experienced higher rates of illness and death from COVID-19. And because of that, some experts argue they should go to the front of the line to receive the new shot. The other is that throughout U.S. history, those same groups have been subjected to medical racism, used to test techniques and treatments, or the withholding of treatments, for someone else's benefit. In other words, the people who might need the vaccine the most might also have the most reason to be suspicious of it, and yet, if they refuse it, might be the most likely to suffer the worst effects of the disease. Just about every minority group residing in the United States can point to what feels like a reasonable basis for suspicion. For African Americans, there's not only the notorious Tuskegee study, which withheld syphilis treatment from rural black men, but also experiments that used enslaved women to perfect surgical techniques and studies that tested new drugs in poor neighborhoods without adequate consent. The Latino community can point to the syphilis study in Guatemala that was even more unethical than the Tuskegee one, and to pharma companies basing tests on the first versions of birth control pills, which caused significant side effects in Puerto Rico and also in Haiti. Attempting to pass smallpox to Native Americans via contaminated blankets is an infamous episode in colonial-era history, and the U.S. government has underfunded the Indian Health Service since its 1955 founding, depriving reservation dwellers of what should have been guaranteed medical care. People really feel right now in our communities that we're being used as guinea pigs to create something that will benefit others, said Abigail Echo Hawk, a citizen of the Pawnee Nation of Oklahoma, who is chief research officer at the Seattle Indian Health Board and director of the Urban Indian Health Institute. Though the COVID-19 vaccine trial sponsored by the National Institutes of Health attempted to recruit Native American participants, the rush to enroll them quickly just made distrust worse, Echo Hawk said. People were feeling they were being coerced into it, which is the opposite of informed consent. So when we actually do have a vaccine, as a result of these missteps, we're going to have to really address the safety component, because right now, the fear is the worst I've seen it. Moving too fast and not paying attention to minority groups' history with the government is causing problems for reaching Latino groups as well, said Renee Najera, an epidemiologist who teaches at Johns Hopkins University and George Mason University. So it's not understanding that within an ethnic group, not everyone has the same concerns. For the Mexican and Central American cohort, the question is, am I going to be asked to produce papers? Am I going to have to register in some database, said Najira, whose family is originally from Mexico. Permanent residents are worried about the Trump administration and the change to the public charge rule. They are fearful that using the health department or getting your vaccines could keep them from becoming citizens. And then within the Puerto Rican community, there's a memory of unethical medical practices. Savoy, who is African-American, sees patients at a clinic in North Philadelphia in a historically poor zip code. Every year, she says she has heard concerns about flu shots from some of her patients, worries about that the shot contains, fears that people are being used as test subjects. News coverage of the White House's push to get the COVID-19 vaccine out quickly, even the name of the effort, Warp Speed, has made all that much worse. People say, I always was suspicious that the government was trying to do stuff to me, and now I'm seeing on TV the government is clearly doing things that don't seem to be above board, she says. Among her black patients are grandparents who are old enough to have been included in the Tuskegee study, which was launched in 1932 and didn't end until 1972, 4 years after a whistleblower made it public. They will tell me that there are certain things that they will trust me on and certain things that they love me for, but they just know that I'm just not old enough to know any better yet, Savoy says. Among her white patients, Savoy adds, there is similar distrust, not from any significant scandal such as Tuskegee, but from the experience of being a poor person in America. They have been in situations where they feel like the government or society didn't protect them, she says, and they see this as another situation where they can be harmed. So to get vaccine acceptance, public health planners have a lot of work to do, which includes taking the time to refine messages about vaccine safety that acknowledge the harms done to minority communities in the name of health. It also includes identifying the channels where people are now likely to encounter misinformation from Facebook or WhatsApp or local radio, not WAKT, and finding people who can deliver credible messages on them. That probably doesn't mean members of the government public health establishment, but it could mean local physicians or community health workers or influencers, or people who occupy more than one of those categories, such as the doctors and nurses taking to TikTok, the volunteers knocking down disinfo on social media, and the vaccine research coordinator posting COVID-19 Instagram memes. At the same time, it's important not to be reductive. The history of the black community is not only Tuskegee, and it would be unthoughtful to assume that all people from that community react to a politicized fast-track vaccine through that frame. In considering what would cause minority groups to be hesitant about the COVID-19 vaccine, researchers who come from within those communities say it's equally important to consider what might cause them to accept it. How many people of every race and ethnicity are worried about cost, worried about access, worried about whether or not they have health insurance, asked Jewel Mullen, a physician and associate dean for health equity at the University of Texas at Austin's Dell Medical School, who is African American. There are a lot of other considerations that can be in the way of somebody wanting to receive a vaccine. It's difficult to remember in the rush to get people vaccinated, or what will be a rush once a vaccine exists, but vaccination is a part of healthcare, and the most successful healthcare programs begin with a conversation about signs and symptoms, sure, but also about what worries people and what they value. It's still not known, after all, just what the coming vaccine will do: prevent infection, reduce severity of illness, keep people from dying. A person's willingness to take the vaccine might depend on that answer, as much as on their knowledge or history. Knowledge of history or past experience with other vaccines. Perhaps a good message would be, while we understand how important it will be for people to believe in the safety of the vaccine so that they can decide whether or not they want to receive one, we are equally committed to talking to them about the other issues that might be on their minds, Mullen says. The experience of reaching out to people about COVID-19 vaccines, she adds, should not just be about convincing them. It should be about reminding them that healthcare workers care about their well-being. Okay, in other vaccine news, this from the New York Times. Children in U.S. may miss 9 million vaccine doses in 2020, report warns. Children in the United States are on pace this year to miss 9 million vaccine doses for measles, polio, and other highly contagious diseases, according to medical claims data, a disruption that healthcare authorities call alarming and attributed to the coronavirus pandemic. The data was made public on Wednesday by the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, one of the nation's largest federations of insurance companies, which said that routine childhood vaccinations had declined by as much as 26% compared to 2019. The findings emerged less than 2 weeks after the World Health Organization and UNICEF warned that progress vaccinating children from polio and measles has been threatened by the pandemic. In an emergency call to action, the two organizations said that the risk of measles and polio outbreaks was on the rise. And just last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization reported that measles deaths worldwide had soared to their highest level in 23 years in 2019 and were 50% higher than just 3 years earlier. Dr. Megan Rainey, an emergency physician at Brown University in Rhode Island, who specializes in public health research, said that failure to maintain childhood vaccine rates could compromise what is known as herd immunity. The term refers to the point at which disease stops spreading because nearly everyone in a population has become immune to it. We know that once you fall below herd immunity, it offers a foothold for these deadly childhood diseases to once again rear their heads in our communities, Dr. Rainey said. The United States is perilously close to falling below the herd immunity threshold for polio. According to the Blue Cross data, the vaccine rate for measles and the whooping cough or pertussis for 2020 were expected to fall below the thresholds for herd immunity set by public health authorities. It would be a horrible irony for us to get through this pandemic and lose children to these preventable diseases. Okay, well, also trying to cover any kind of non-COVID story, although that one's related to COVID. This one's only very, I suppose, a little bit related to COVID. With the holidays and COVID-19 fatigue setting in, this from The Hill. Science supports new dietary guidelines limiting alcohol consumption. Probably not a good way to deal with stress, though, anyways. But okay, here we go. Recently, an advisory committee of 20 nationally recognized scientific experts recommended changing federal dietary guidelines on alcohol consumption, with limits for men who drink lowered from 2 drinks per day to 1 drink per day. The recommendations are driven by solid evidence. Even moderate alcohol consumption is associated with significant health risks. The experts' report explains why. These experts are not ideologues. Indeed, they were all appointed by the Trump administration. Nevertheless, the alcohol industry and its allies have attempted to caricature the committee members as, quote, nanny state bureaucrats. In the help of lobbying budget in excess of $27 million, Big Alcohol has enlisted the support of congressional representatives in second-guessing the committee's recommendations. Federal officials should stand their ground and incorporate the experts' recommendations into the dietary guidelines for Americans. The preponderance of scientific and medical knowledge, the legally prescribed basis for the dietary guidelines, made crystal clear that the recommendations reflect the best science available today. U.S. researchers now estimate that drinking alcohol is the third most significant cause of cancer that is within a person's control, behind smoking and obesity. Each year, alcohol consumption causes more cancer deaths than exposure to ultraviolet radiation. In fact, drinking alcohol increases the risk of at least 6 cancer types. The cancer risk increases with heavier levels of consumption, but an established and growing body of research shows that even light alcohol consumption, less than 1 drink per day, also causes cancer, with the incidence of cancer of the breast, oral cavity, pharynx, and esophagus, among others, increasing significantly among light drinkers. With the exception of breast cancer, the types of cancer known to be caused by drinking alcohol, stomach, esophageal, head and neck, colorectal, and liver, are much more common in men, pointing to a need for men in particular to cut back. By contrast, earlier claims that moderate drinking confers health benefits, including improved cardiovascular health, have not aged well. The availability of large prospective cohort studies and the advent of whole genome sequencing technology have allowed researchers to bypass some of the confounding factors that plagued earlier studies, and the results of this genetic epidemiology have cast further doubt on the purported protective effects of moderate drinking. All this is to say the evidence in support of moderate alcohol consumption improving cardiovascular health is highly suspect, whereas the scientific evidence linking alcohol consumption to cancer is well established and growing. Respected cancer organizations, including the American Institute for Cancer Research and the American Cancer Society, advise not drinking alcohol to reduce cancer risk. The federal dietary guidelines should also advise consumers that drinking alcohol does not improve health, and if consumers do drink, urge them to drink as little as possible. Will the modest change proposed for the dietary guidelines have a significant impact? Millions of men in the U.S. now regularly drink in excess of the 2-drink limit, first prescribed in the 1990 guidelines. But the guidelines do matter. They're required by law to be promoted by all federal government food and nutrition programs and policies, and they are often used by private and nonprofit organizations too. For decades, alcohol has been depicted as part of a healthy diet, with any ill effects limited to binge drinkers and alcoholics. This portrayal has succeeded so well that most consumers in the United States remain unaware of the link between alcohol use and cancer. The American Institute for Cancer Research recent survey showed that less than half of U.S. consumers identify alcohol as a cancer risk factor. For the sake of our collective health, that needs to change. The dietary guidelines can help, so long as they are driven by science and not corporate influence. Okay, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can queue up future shows at toppun.com/blog/WAKT, or you can search on Facebook for Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, and like the page. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.